This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa idh qala Ibrahim rabbi arini kayfa tuhyil mauta qala awalam tu'min qala bala walakin liyatma'inna qalbi قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. And when Abraham said, "My Lord, show me how you revive the dead," he said, "Do you not believe?" He said, "Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest." He said, "Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them. They will come to you, hastening. And know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront.
Israel frees 39 Palestinian prisoners, all women and children, in exchange for 24 captives held by Hamas as part of a temporary truce in Gaza. The Hamas leader says the Palestinian resistance forces forced Israel, that is, into accepting the group's terms for a cessation of hostilities. And leader of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement says that Israel will eventually be forced to release all Palestinian prisoners. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. A four-day truce has kicked into effect in the Gaza Strip, first pause in over 7 weeks of Israeli aggression. Temporary ceasefire came into force at 500 GMT Friday. However, two people were killed as the Israeli army used live fire and tear gas to stop Palestinians in southern Gaza from returning to their homes in the north. Under the deal, desperately needed aid will be allowed into the enclave. Also, a group of 24 captives held by Hamas have been handed over to the regime's forces. In return, 39 Palestinian prisoners, all of them women and children, were released. Israeli forces attacked hundreds of people awaiting the release of the Palestinian prisoners outside Israel's Ofer prison in the occupied West Bank. They fired volleys of tear gas and live fire at the crowd, injuring two people. Gaza truce follows 48 days of relentless Israeli airstrikes that killed over 15,000 Palestinians and displaced around 1.7 million. And in defiance of Israeli threats, Palestinians have been celebrating the release of their prisoners by the regime as part of a four-day Gaza truce. The 39 released Palestinians are all women and children. Israel threatened to re-arrest the prisoners in case of any celebrations upon their release. The Israeli regime also warned the freed Palestinians not to discuss their prison conditions. However, the free prisoners have already revealed that Palestinian detainees are suffering serious medical neglect during detention, and many now need medical attention. Israel released 39 Palestinians in exchange for 24 captives held by Hamas following Operation Al-Aqsa Flood on October 7th. Earlier, we were joined by political analyst Jim Kavanaugh and asked for his take on the temporary truce in Gaza.
The regime was never really interested in saving the hostages, the captives. I think they're interested in destroying Gaza and depopulating Gaza. It's an ethnic cleansing operation. And they have a policy called the Hannibal Directive, which is to kill hostages, to attack places where hostages are held, because they don't want the hostages to be used as political tools against them, which, of course, that's what they are. So they were never really interested in going after the hostages. That was clear. They didn't go after the hospital, Shifa Hospital, because there were hostages hidden there. They destroyed hospitals because they wanted to destroy hospitals. Now, what's happened in Israel is, of course, there's been political pushback from the hostage families and their constituency saying, do something for the hostages. I think that's the only reason Netanyahu has agreed to do this now, because he's got to give himself some cover politically in Israel that, okay, I am doing something for the hostages. I want to do something for the hostages. Of course, he set up this situation where not only the Palestinians aren't supposed to celebrate, but the hostages, the Israeli hostages have been released, are locked away and kept from the media and told they will be fined if they talk to the media. So, you know, the hostages are a problem for Israel. They didn't really want them back. They wanted to use them as an excuse for ethnic cleansing of Gaza.
The Hamas resistance movement says it remains committed to the implementation of the Gaza truce as long as Israel adheres to the deal. Hamas political bureau chief says that the group is prepared to continue countering Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip after the truce ends. Ismail Haniyeh said resistance is able to confront the Israeli regime, break its will, and thwart its plans. He said the enemy failed to weaken the will of the Palestinian nation and its heroic resistance, and that's why it accepted terms of the truce. Haniyeh expressed gratitude to Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied territories for their steadfastness. He also went on to thank resistance groups in the region, including Hezbollah in Lebanon and others in Iraq and Yemen. The Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Resistance Movement says that the Israeli regime failed to achieve its stated goals in Gaza. In a televised address, Ziad al-Nakhala added, "Current prisoner swap deal with Tel Aviv will ultimately lead to another agreement that will force the regime into releasing all Palestinian prisoners." He said that the resistance front will continue fighting and prevent the enemy from reaching its objectives. Nakhala noted October 7th Operation Al-Aqsa flood caused an earthquake within the Israeli regime and shed light on the Western support for Israel. He also thanked resistance groups out of Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen for courageously supporting Palestinians. And now joining us for an update is Ashraf Shannon, joining us from Khan Yunis. Ashraf, you could please, the latest with respect to people's living conditions in Gaza and this truce that's supposed to give them some relief.
Well, Danny, 26 hours on this humanitarian pause continues to hold despite grave violations by the Israeli regime yesterday when they shot and killed two IDPs from Gaza City who were trying to make their way from the southern part of Gaza Strip to the northern part of the Gaza Strip, and they also injured seven others. And last night, around 11:30 p.m., Israeli fighter jets did a couple of sorties in the skies of Khan Yunis, which is a violation of the truce. They're not supposed to fly any of their planes anywhere in the southern part of the Gaza Strip as part of the truce. The resistance factions, mainly Hamas's military wing, the Zil Qassam brigades, did not retaliate to these violations. But as far as the IDPs mainly are concerned, thousands of them who were staying inside Nasser Hospital right here in the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis have made their way back home to the eastern parts of Khan Yunis, to a Sharqiya area, Bani Suhaila, Abassan al-Kabira and al-Saghira, as well as Khuza'a and other places like Sirat, Maghazi, and the Bridge refugee camp, as well as Deir al-Balah. But those who returned back to their homes, it was to the shock that most of their homes were bombed and destroyed, and they hardly have anything to go back to. And when you talk to people who went back and return to the hospital for, you know, to run some errands, they tell you we couldn't recognize our neighborhoods in the eastern parts of Khan Yunis. So there is mass destruction in Khuza'a and Bani Suhaila and other areas in the eastern parts of Khan Yunis. While in Gaza City and the northern parts of the Gaza Strip, the areas there are destroyed beyond recognition. And yesterday, when the few hundred people who wanted to return to their homes close to the Rantisa Children's Hospital, they were shot at by Israeli forces. But fortunately, no one was killed. Now, the Israeli forces stations inside Shifa Hospital yesterday morning before the start of the humanitarian pause, they relocated to Al-Rashid Road. That's the coastal road in Gaza City, and they also relocated to the Saladin Road to the eastern part. So inside the residential areas, there is no presence of Israeli soldiers like we had over the last 3 or 4 weeks with the snipers all over the rooftops and so on. People return to their homes. They have no electricity, no running water, no sewage system, basically no food or drinking water or any health system whatsoever. And because the health sector, for example, in the northern parts of the Gaza Strip was completely destroyed. Only the Protestant Church Hospital, also known as Al-Ahli Al-Arabi Hospital, is partially functioning. That's the only hospital functioning in the northern parts of the Gaza Strip. While here in the southern parts of the Gaza Strip, Khan Yunis Hospital has two hospitals, Nasser and the Gaza European Hospital, and we also have the Deir el-Balah Hospital. And up until this moment, they have no medicines and no anesthesia. They're still performing medical procedures without anesthesia. And the capacity of the hospitals are more than 200% right now, as hundreds of wounded people from the northern parts of the Gaza Strip over the last 3 or 4 days, they were brought in here, and they added more pressure on the already collapsing health sector in the southern Gaza. This, while the aid that came in, including the fuel, is not enough for anything. It's hardly enough to keep the hospitals in the Gaza Strip running for 3 or 4 days if they continue to bring in the fuel. While the aid that's been coming in is basically some canned food, mineral water, and blankets and mattresses. Maybe the only medical aid that came in was a field hospital that was sent by the United Arab Emirates to Gaza.
Okay, Ashraf, thank you for that thorough update there. Stay safe. Ashraf Shannon there joining us from Khan Yunis. Meanwhile, Iran's besieged volunteer forces have held nationwide rallies in solidarity, with Palestinians in Gaza. In the capital, Tehran, over 50,000 members of the volunteer force turned out to condemn Israel's atrocities. Gisu Misha Ahmadi takes us there.
Marching towards Al-Quds, as they called it, over 5,000 members of Iran's besieged volunteer forces took to the streets downtown Tehran in one of the largest gatherings held in the Iranian capital to express their outrage at the ongoing Israeli bloodshed in Gaza and the deliberate targeting of children. Carrying the Palestinian flag, they chanted slogans against the occupying Israeli regime and its Western backers, the U.S. in particular, as they condemned the genocide in the besieged territory.
The besieged force is actually Iran's ordinary people, the ones who pray in mosques. So what you see here is the huge support of Iranians for men, women and children in Gaza.
My message to the kids in Gaza is that we will always support them.
More than 14,000 innocent Muslims have been killed so far. According to the statistics, nearly 7,000 of those who have been killed are children. As a member of the besieged volunteer force, I just had to take part in this rally. The oppressed people in Gaza should know that they are not alone.
Many demonstrators also carried bundled white shrouds symbolizing the children killed in Gaza in the Israeli attacks on schools and hospitals.
Everywhere in the world, people agree, and also according to international law, attacking hospitals is a war crime. As a member of the besieged force in the Faculty of Medicine, I'm here to condemn the war crimes committed by the Israeli regime.
Whenever in a war you see one side taking unconventional measures, it's a clear sign that they are desperate. Attacking women and children and killing children shows how weak the Israelis are. The people of Palestine should know that their victory is near.
We will always support the suppressed people of Palestine. All the people that you see here have come to condemn the Israeli regime. We will defend them till our last drop of blood.
The government's media office in Gaza announced on Thursday that at least 14,800 people have been killed in the Israeli attack so far, including nearly 7,000 children, while over 36,000 have also been injured. 60% of the homes in Gaza have also been destroyed.
Since the beginning of the Israeli war on Gaza, not a day has gone by that Iranians have come out on the streets to show their support for the Palestinian people. More than 10 million people have so far signed up to go to Gaza. Gizumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
Children from various backgrounds in the Pakistani capital Islamabad have marched hand in hand to express unwavering solidarity with their peers in Gaza.
In a heartwarming display of empathy and solidarity, thousands of school children from private and public schools across Pakistan gathered at a spirited children's rally to express their support for the Palestinian children facing the harsh realities of Israel's atrocities in Gaza. The event, marked by a sea of youthful faces, echoed with chants of unity and calls for justice.
Here to tell our Palestine sisters and brothers that they are not alone. We are always stand with them and we always raise our voice for them.
I'm here to support Palestine and support kids like me. My message is that the Palestinians shall be free.
These Pakistani children, armed with compassion, stood united to condemn the injustices that Palestinian children face amid the ongoing war in Gaza.
We are here to show our support to the children of Palestine. We stand with them.
I am here to support the Palestinian children and I stand with them.
The rally served as a testament to the power of education in fostering compassion and empathy, transcending geographical boundaries to create a global community that stands against oppression. Children here in Pakistan called for a world in which each and every child's rights are safeguarded and respected.
Through their participation in these pro-Palestine rallies, Pakistani school children not only supported the solidarity narrative, but also reminded the international community of profound resonance of Israel's onslaught on Gaza within the younger generation, which values justice, empathy, and peace. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Thanks for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
Like the Zionist regime, the U.S. has systematically violated international law in its wars, manufactured political justifications to suit each case, and evaded international accountability. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, copying U.S. war crimes is precisely what makes the Israeli regime's actions illegal, and it is the world's failure to hold the U.S. accountable that has emboldened the Israeli regime to believe it, too, can kill with impunity. The U.S. systematically violates the U.N. Charter's prohibition against the threat or use of force, manufacturing political justifications to suit each case and using its Security Council veto to evade international accountability. Its military lawyers employ unique, exceptional interpretations of the Fourth Geneva Convention, under which the universal protections it guarantees to civilians are treated as secondary to U.S. military objectives. The U.S. fiercely resists the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court to ensure that its exceptional interpretations of international law are never subjected to impartial judicial scrutiny. When the U.S. did allow the International Court of Justice to rule on its war against Nicaragua in 1986, the ICJ ruled that its deployment of the Contras to invade and attack Nicaragua and its mining of Nicaragua's ports were acts of aggression in violation of international law and ordered the U.S. to pay war reparations to Nicaragua. When the U.S. declared that it would no longer recognize the jurisdiction of the ICJ and failed to pay up, Nicaragua asked the UN Security Council to enforce their reparations, but the US vetoed the resolution. Atrocities like Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the bombing of German and Japanese cities to unhouse the civilian population, as Winston Churchill called it, together with horrors of Germany's Nazis, led to adoption of the new Fourth Geneva Convention in 1949, to protect civilians in war zones and under military occupation. On the 50th anniversary of the convention in 1999, the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, which is responsible for monitoring international compliance with the Geneva Conventions, conducted a survey to see how well people in different countries understood the protections the convention provides. They surveyed people in 12 countries that had been victims of war, in 4 countries, including France, Russia, the UK, and the US, that are permanent members of the Security Council, and in Switzerland, where the ICRC is based. The ICRC published the results of the survey in 2000 in a report titled People on War, Civilians in Line of Fire. The survey asked people to choose between a correct understanding of the convention's civilian protections and a watered-down interpretation of them that closely resembles that of U.S. and Israeli regime military lawyers. The correct understanding was defined by a statement that combatants must attack only other combatants and leave civilians alone. The weaker, incorrect statement was that combatants should avoid civilians as much as possible as they conduct military operations. Between 72 and 77% of the people in other Security Council countries and Switzerland agreed with the correct statement, but the United States was an outlier, with only 52% agreeing. In fact, 42% of Americans agreed with weaker statement, twice as many as in other countries. There were similar disparities between the U.S. and others on questions about torture and the treatment of prisoners of war. In U.S.-occupied Iraq, the U.S. exceptionally weak interpretations of the Geneva Conventions led to endless disputes with the ICRC and the UN Assistance Mission for Iraq, UNAMI, which issued damning quarterly human rights reports. UNAMI consistently maintained that U.S. airstrikes in densely populated civilian areas were violations of international law. For instance, its human rights report for the second quarter of 2007 documented UNAMI's investigations of 15 incidents in which U.S. occupation forces killed 103 Iraqi civilians, including 27 killed in an airstrike in Khalidiya near Ramadi on April 3rd, and 7 children killed in a helicopter attack on an elementary school in Diyala province on May 8. UNAMI demanded that all credible allegations of unlawful killings by MNF, multinational force, be thoroughly, promptly, and impartially investigated, and appropriate action taken against military personnel found to have used excessive or indiscriminate force. A footnote explained, customary international humanitarian law demands that, as much as possible, military objectives must not be located within areas densely populated by civilians. The presence of individual combatants among a great number of civilians does not alter the civilian character of an area. UNAMI also rejected U.S. claims that its widespread killing of civilians was the result of the Iraqi resistance using civilians as human shields, another U.S. propaganda trope that the Zionist regime is mimicking today. Israeli regime accusations of human shielding are even more absurd in the densely populated, confined space of Gaza, where the whole world can see that it is Israel that is placing civilians in the line of fire as they desperately seek safety from the Zionist regime's bombardment. Calls for a ceasefire in Gaza are echoing around the world, through the halls of the United Nations, from a newly united front of previously divided West Asian leaders, and in the streets of London and Washington. The world is withdrawing its consent for a genocidal two-state solution in which the Zionist regime and the U.S. regime are the only two states that can settle the fate of Palestine. If the United States and Israeli regime leaders are hoping that they can squeak through this crisis and that the public's habitually short attention span will wash away the world's horror at the crimes we are all witnessing, that's maybe yet another serious misjudgment. As Hannah Arendt wrote in 1950 in the preface of The Origins of Totalitarianism, we can no longer afford to take that which was good in the past and simply call it our heritage. To discard the bad and simply think of it as a dead load, which by itself time will bury in oblivion. The subterranean stream of Western history has finally come to the surface and usurped the dignity of our tradition. This is the reality in which we live. And this is why all efforts to escape from the grims of the present into nostalgia for a still intact past or into the anticipated oblivion of a better future are in vain.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. I'm Saeed Pourreza, with you for some of the biggest talking points coming out of the ongoing slaughter of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and beyond. So why the last-minute delay in the expected four-day truce? What happens after? Will there be a longer pause? Will global public pressure push leaders to call for a ceasefire? Let's discuss all of that and more with a musician, artist, and activist who goes by the stage name The Vanabond, and via Skype from Sheffield, UK, British-Chilean journalist and filmmaker Pablo Navarrete. Pablo is the director of Inside the Revolution, A Journey into the Heart of Venezuela, and founder and editor of Alborada.net, a website covering the politics and culture of Latin America. Thank you both for being here, gentlemen. Let me start with you, The Vanabond. A little over 6 weeks into this war on Gaza, nearly 15,000 people dead, thousands of them children. Your initial reflections on that?
Nothing. That's basically creating maybe another 60,000 more enemies instead of killing the enemy. It's a wrong way of doing it. Absolutely, it isn't. It needs to be uprooted, that problem. You can't kill your way into owning Gaza again.
Violence breeds more violence, no doubt. And Pablo, the same question to you on the death toll, so many thousands killed and mounting.
There aren't really any words that do justice to the level of savagery that is being inflicted on the Palestinian people by Israel. And it is deeply shameful, and that the British government, my parents are Chileans that were forced to flee a fascist dictatorship that was supported by the US government and financed and overthrew a government. And today the US is financing another sort of fascistic government in Israel, which is inflicting a level of barbarity on the Palestinians where, you know, the images that we are seeing of the children, of the people, of people dying, of being bombed, it's just beyond shocking. And the media silence in the mainstream British media around the role of the UK historically in being an ally of Israel, and even just today, there are reports that there are RAF flights from Cyprus that are shrouded in secrecy, that the government refuses to say what the purpose is. So this connection where the British government is aiding and abetting a genocide in Palestine is you know, something that that we as British people need to call our government to account on.
And the Vatabond, we will talk about your documentary on this decades-long conflict. Of course, some people will take issue with the word conflict because there's no parity in terms of the power of the two sides. But I understand that you are from a heavily pro-Zionist background.
Absolutely.
And even spent time in a kibbutz.
I did.
What was your experience like? What were you told about your Arab neighbors, Palestinian neighbors?
Well, it didn't start at a kibbutz. It started in my upbringing. I was raised in a Jewish school in Mexico. And it's always, they portray Israel, that's the place, that's the good guys. They never start the wars, all the paraphernalia of the army, those are the good guys, those are the heroes. And, you know, when I woke up, when you start listening to the media and you actually research, luckily you wake up, if you're a good person, I think.
And like I said, you spent time in the kibbutz as well, is that right?
I did.
So what kind of stuff were you told there? If you could give us a few examples about your neighbors.
While I was there, it was actually the second Intifada, like 2000. I was actually there when the Twin Towers fell.
Wow, 2001.
Yeah.
September 11.
And nothing. They're so proud of this army thing. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't call it Israel. I'd call it the 51st state of America. You know, it's just easier to call it that way.
Wow.
I think, like, it's placed very strategically. It's like this huge military base for the U.S., isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I think.
I think that's something Pablo would want to talk about as well, calling Israel the 50 what?
The 51st state.
51st America.
Is that right?
American state. Well, there's debate about that. But, yeah, the U.S. support for Israel, the billions in military aid from U.S. taxpayer money for the Israelis, and also the fact that on October 7th, the Vatabond talked about you know, how proud the Israelis may be of their military. That the Israeli myth of invincibility was shattered on that October 7th surprise attack.
No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I'm just bringing it back to sort of Latin America and this idea of Israel being the U.S.'s enforcer military base. Until recently, one of the other biggest recipients of U.S. military aid in Latin America was Colombia, which was called the Israel of Latin America because of its strategic role in enforcing U.S. imperialism in Latin America in the same way that Israel plays that role in the Middle East and beyond. And dramatically and perhaps unexpectedly for many people, since Colombia was a republic in 1810, it elected its first government, left-wing government, only recently, that took office in August 2022, Gustavo Petro. And so that enforcer that it has historically had is no longer a kind of client state in the way it was. And Petro has been a very vocal critic of what the current genocidal policies of Israel. So it shows that that the U.S., has used Israel, is using Israel, has been arm in arm with Israel throughout this genocidal campaign in Palestine, as has Britain. But that former enforcers that it had in Latin America are no longer playing ball. And I think that's interesting. And again, it shows how Latin America is once again at the forefront of a solidarity with Palestine that it has shown because of a shared history of being, you know, victims of imperialism or settler colonialism. And so I think Latin America is showing, even to the Middle Eastern states, what a level of solidarity with Palestine should be. And Bolivia obviously broke relations on the 31st of October, and then successive.
I will pick up on that later on in the show. But for now, we're going to make a short pause here and hear from the Palestinian permanent observer to the UN, Riyad Mansour, who has had some powerful words for the assembled dignitaries at the World Body's chamber. Have a listen.
Israeli leaders keep talking about voluntary resettlement, quote unquote. This is the code name for forced transfer. What is voluntary about bombing and besieging and killing and maiming and arresting and humiliating? You deprive 2.3 million people of the means for their own survival and then tell them they have a choice. Leave this land or leave this earth. That's the choice that they're giving them. The Nakba has to end. I repeat, the Nakba has to end. Despair, devastation, destruction will never bring security to Israel. Dispossession, displacement, and denial of Palestinian rights will never bring security to Israel. Because you all knew this was Israelis' intentions, to wipe us from the face of earth, which will never happen, never, never happen. We should not be blind to each other's wounds or traumas or history, nor dismiss them. But that respect has to be built on a common vision of the future, where all can live and let live in freedom, in dignity, and in peace and security, not where one's life is at the expense of the other. There is no coexistence with supremacy or subjugation.
All right, let me continue the discussion here with my guests in the studio and Skype. The Vanaban, so we heard what Mr. Mansour had to say there. The sheer number of people, again, who have been killed over the past 6 weeks or so, a lot of people are using the word ethnic cleansing, genocide. Others are saying collective punishment of Palestinians merely for being Palestinians. What is your view on that?
Yeah, well, it's all of the above, no? It's like, how long has it been? Like, they don't want peace, do they? They just want the land. Or every single person they kill is just creating more people, more anger. It is now embedded in everyone there. Mm-hmm. Is there a solution at this point? It's like, it's really crazy what the politicians have done. It's like, it's so sad because it could be so beautiful there. I was there, you know? Mm-hmm. It is a beautiful place, unfortunately, or fortunately, you know? It's like, imagine there being in a restaurant, there's Arabs, there's Jews, everyone cheering up. It would be so cool, but they don't want that.
Do you think we're, because of what has been happening and still is, we're further away from a solution, or is there a vigor and some kind of urgency for a political solution?
It's the furthest that I've seen, I think.
What do you think, Pablo? Do you think, you know, we're further away from a settlement or a solution, or do you think there's some kind of an urgency and vigor among the leaders or the international community to find a permanent political solution to this decades-long conflict?
It's a tough question. I think what has happened is that there's been a threshold that's been, I think, passed in respect to, like, just the masses of the populations around the world, in Latin America, in the UK, in Europe, where the political class and the media class have played their hand with respect to what, you know, how they act when something like a pro-Western genocide is taking place, where they look for every single way to minimize, to silence, to obfuscate, to misrepresent. And I think it's become so abundantly clear that there is no pretense of impartiality by the BBC or by the, you know, the corporate, that I think that large sectors of the population have had, you know, if they were ambiguous as to the what was going on with regards to Israel and Palestine, I think they've seen really what Israeli apartheid, what Israeli settler colonialism means, and its savagery, and what Zionism means in Palestine. So I think that in terms of the sort of civil society, if you want to call it that, I think that there is an impetus now to really take forward initiatives such as BDS, boycott, divest, sanctions campaign, to really, you know, Israel is now beyond the pale. And I think that obviously is not the case with the political class in somewhere like the UK. But I think there's a disconnect now, and you're seeing it with this kind of pro-genocide consensus in the Labour and Tory party. And you think, I think Labour, even though they've been well ahead in the polls, are going to suffer a lot. And so there might be movements in the British political system as a result of this that could at least help or pave the way to a more progressive future. And ultimately, I think the British people know that that a political class that supports, that aids and abets a genocide is not a political class that is needed for Britain.
Mm-hmm. In the Vatican, I mean, first of all, I understand perfectly well, appreciate that this is may not be a very easy situation for you. You're here on your own volition, speaking your mind and your position for the first time. So feel free to say whatever you want. But I want to talk about your documentary. Briefly, tell our viewers what it is and when you did it and what does it cover.
Well, it's about the London rallies, and we talk a little bit about the story and the history of the conflict. But it's very, very beautifully illustrated with beautiful music and beautiful sounds. Like, it's really something. It's called Peace Plan Palestina. Mm. And I got Ashkan, I don't know if has he been here, interviewed? Like the director, the writer of the script.
Yeah.
Has he been here? And we just hit it. It was great working with him, so we just continued. And we're doing another documentary on another thing, but
okay,
it was great. It was, you know...
So what informed that decision to make this documentary?
Well, why not? I've always... Can I tell you? The reason why I'm so empathetic with the Palestinians is because I've been the Palestinian in my family. Mm-hmm. So... I know what they feel.
Expand on what that means to be the Palestinian in your family.
I know what it is to be left to die, to not care what happens, to be isolated, to be neglected, to be a second-class family member.
Mm-hmm. For your views.
Yes, in my views, but it is true. So, yeah, I don't know, I'm just too empathetic because...
Yeah.
In the rallies, like, we met a woman, she was from Haifa.
Yeah.
And she was saying that everything was cool before the Haganah and the Irgun, you know, these two. Everything was cool. Everything could have been perfect. It was convivence, and everybody was just cool. But then they started just wanting more.
Yeah.
And then people talk about the 1947 partition, but then you got to see, like, were you there? Nobody was there. We don't know the conditions, you know. So anyway, that's
how it all started to come together in the form of this documentary.
When I started doing research, and then alternative people, who I started thinking, these people are too smart to not listen to them. So I just started digging into them. And then you wake up from everything, not just the Palestinian thing. Like, everything needs, mm-hmm. Like, global intifada, everything, like the entire planet.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing. We're going to, again, take another short break here to hear from the UN Secretary General, who has welcomed that agreement reached by Israel and Hamas with the mediation of Qatar and supported by Egypt and the United States. Antonio Guterres' deputy spokesperson, Farah Haq, has said there were monumental issues that still needed to be overcome. Have a listen to this.
Also yesterday, Al-Awda Hospital in North Gaza was attacked, and three doctors and one patient's companion were killed, and many patients injured. Since the start of the war, the World Health Organization has documented 178 health attacks in Gaza Strip that resulted in 22 fatalities and 48 injuries among healthcare workers on duty. Only two small hospitals to the north of Wadi Gaza, one in Gaza City and another in Bitlaya, are estimated to be partially operational and admit patients. with the remaining 22 being out of service. Of the 11 medical facilities in the South, 7 are currently functional. A WHO staff member was killed alongside her 6-month-old baby, her husband, and 2 brothers yesterday. As of the 19th of November, 108 UNRWA staffers have been killed in Gaza since the 7th of October. Nearly 770,000 internally displaced persons, one out of 1.7 million, are sheltering in 99 UNRWA facilities south of Wadi Gaza in extremely overcrowded conditions. In the past 2 weeks, the agency has recorded a 35% increase in skin diseases and a 40% increase in cases of diarrhea.
Earlier, we spoke to Luis Castro, who is a journalist based in Barcelona, Spain, and an analyst on Latin American affairs. We asked him how both Spanish and Latin American, Americans, were assessing the massacre in Gaza.
The perception of the Latin American society is openly supportive of the Palestinians for obvious reasons. Latin America itself has been a continent that's been suffering from abuse from world powers like the USA, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's easy for Latin America to sort of like take the side of what it is, the weak side in this story. So when you go to different countries and you talk to people on the streets, you can easily say, you can easily see how they lean towards supporting the Palestinian cause, and they are obviously outraged by the fact that so many children have been murdered with no compassion, that Israel is not respecting at all any of the treaties or any of the truths like given by even organizations across the world to have a break in this situation. So, yeah, so definitely the Latin Americans are very supportive. Just, I would say that only probably in Argentina is where you find a little bit of more resistance. But generally speaking, all the Latinos are supporting the Palestinian cause. Here in Spain, because also there's a transition of government, like some of the ministers in charge have been very, very strong supporters of the Palestinian cause itself. But on the streets of Spain, generally speaking, when you talk about this, the mood in general is of support of Palestine and the situation in Gaza. The media in Spain, surprisingly, though, has been very open to support Palestine and to constantly denounce and constantly show the abuses of the state of Israel over the Gaza Strip. So it's been kind of surprising and shocking, actually, because normally the media in Spain tends to have a speech leaning towards the right. But in this case, I have to admit that when you switch on the news here in any side of Spain, you see a lot of coverage, mostly from the Palestinian side, talking constantly about the assassinations, the bombings, etc., etc., that the state of Israel has been throwing over the Gaza Strip.
Luis Castro further said that with the exception of a few countries, the tide both in the EU region and in Latin America is changing rapidly as people are seeing through Israel's right to defend itself propaganda.
If you start by the EU, even the strongest, most right-winded politicians in Europe have had to sort of admit at some point and even called Israel to stop. Like even von der Leyen or Borrell, people that are all openly supporters of Israel, have come to the conclusion at some point to actually sort of like ask them to stop. And if you go, and in Latin America, it's the same. Like the mood of the people in general is of open support. It's like it's obvious, especially when you start seeing real news and you realize what the Israeli regime has been throwing over Palestine over the last month. The amount of children, families completely destroyed, infrastructure, absolutely no respect for human rights or international law as usual. So it's impossible to completely be supporting the state of Israel in this case, unless you are just a blinded supporter of Israel, like as I just mentioned, the new elected president of Argentina. So only this group of people will always have an excuse, and they will always say that Israel has the right to defend itself, which is the never-ending excuse of this regime over the last decades. So in this case, I can openly say that my perception is that the changing, the mood, the perception of the general people, the general public all around the world is changing.
We're going to wrap up this show. And let me thank again my guests, the Vanabon, as well as Pablo Navarrete, for sharing their thoughts with us. Gaza Under Attack will definitely be back with more. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Leaders across the Western world have turned a blind eye to Israeli regime war crimes in the besieged Gaza Strip. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned, please. Middle East Eye wrote, since the start of the Zionist regime's bombing of Gaza, the guiding principle for French President Emmanuel Macron has been unwavering and unconditional support for Tel Aviv. Touting the Zionist regime's right to self-defense, France on October 16th voted against a United Nations Security Council resolution that would have condemned violence against civilians. Paris subsequently supported a resolution that called for humanitarian pauses in Gaza, but it was vetoed by the US. French President Emmanuel Macron has since gone further and called for a ceasefire, but this is too little too late. By strongly backing the Zionist regime, despite the disproportionately of the regime's response to the October 7th attack, France effectively gave the Zionist regime government license to massacre of thousands of civilians. There are no adequate words to describe the indecency displayed by leaders across the Western world who have continued to turn a blind eye to the Zionist regime's war crimes and genocidal actions in Gaza. At the same time, the US, UK, France, Germany, and other European countries continue to tout their humanitarian principles, in particular during the recent Gaza Aid Conference in Paris. The tens of thousands of Palestinians killed and wounded by the Zionist regime's bombing in Gaza could have been saved had these powers honored their obligations to international humanitarian law. Instead, they have done the opposite, providing political, economic, and military cover for the Zionist regime's colonial and genocidal ambitions while dehumanizing Palestinians. Since Macron's election, France's authoritarian drift has been well documented, with anti-social policies, police violence and impunity crackdowns on protest, and systematic Islamophobia, among other issues. The UN and other human rights observers have highlighted these failings. If French foreign policy has not yet been analyzed through the prism of this far-right turn, it is probably because such policy is generated outside of democratic and parliamentary controls. Though the General Assembly does have a say in foreign affairs, it rarely translates into concrete opposition. The Constitution and the institutional practice grant the President very extensive powers regarding foreign policy. The Assembly's Foreign Affairs Committee has little influence over foreign policy decision-making processes, and the legislative activity is limited in this area. So overall, the Parliament has little opportunity to distance itself from the government on diplomatic issues and has almost never done so. Indeed, international affairs occupy a limited space within French political debates. In addition, the Western rejection of international law in the name of the Zionist regime's right to self-defense plays into a virulent type of authoritarianism, prompting a worldview devoid of moral sense. At the same time, France has taken steps to criminalize solidarity with the Palestinian people, which amounts to criminalizing opposition to genocide by banning protests, expelling activists, and targeting anti-Israel boycott campaigns. In the current context, any criticism of government policy is framed as terrorism, a standard rhetorical process employed by authoritarian regimes. France's blind support for the Zionist regime's military is a political choice and not a foregone conclusion, as shown by the diverging positions